You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Last month, the city of Detroit declared bankruptcy. An emergency manager had been appointed by the governor of Michigan to run Detroit with power over and above the city's elected officials. In explaining the bankruptcy, the cost of maintaining pensions for past and current city employees received much of the blame. But are there other factors to consider? Richard Wolff is a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. He's also an author as well as host of his own syndicated radio show called Economic Update. And Professor Richard Wolff joins me by phone this morning from New York. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Now, first of all, let's start with what's happening in Detroit now. Could you explain what's going on now?
Yes. Detroit is a little bit in a class by itself. It's the largest city in American history to declare bankruptcy, to get itself into such an extreme situation. Just to give you an idea, in 1950, when Detroit was synonymous with the then-booming automobile industry, the leading industry of the United States for several decades after World War II, its population reached just short of 2 million. Today, its population is below 700,000, a catastrophic collapse, not only of a city's economy, but literally of the capacity of its citizens to survive there, so that an overwhelming majority have left over the last 20 and 30 years. The obvious cause of this has nothing to do with workers' pensions, public employees' pensions. That is simply an attempt at this point to take advantage of a crisis by scapegoating a group that has been targeted by conservatives for a long time. The obvious causes that everyone recognizes who hasn't got an ulterior motive is the fact that the American automobile industry has been shrinking and the city dependent on that industry has been in trouble ever since. Everyone in North America is aware that the biggest car company by sales is the Toyota company, and that is not an American corporation, et cetera, et cetera. With the decline of the automobile industry came enormous troubles for Detroit. When millions of car workers lost their jobs in Detroit, partly because American companies couldn't compete with their Japanese and European alternatives, partly because American corporations made mistakes strategically in terms of fuel-efficient cars and many other kinds of questions, they lost the competition to the likes of Honda and Toyota and so on. And they laid off large numbers of workers. Those workers then couldn't pay taxes because they weren't earning much. Their houses went into disrepair. They couldn't maintain the mortgages to hold on to their homes. And the spiral downturn of Detroit was underway. Over the last several decades, various efforts have been made by the state of Michigan, by the federal government, most recently in 2008 and 2009, as part of the meltdown here, the federal government of the United States bailed out two of the three major car companies, General Motors and Chrysler, and forced an agreement on the United Auto Workers to basically allow auto workers to be paid much less in the future than they had been paid in the past, which means that even if employment for auto goes up again, it will not help Detroit because the new hiring of more workers will occur at roughly half the hourly wage that used to pertain in that sector.
So the bailout then didn't actually save the jobs?
No, that's the horrible irony of it. What the bailout did was save the corporations, Chrysler and General Motors. And what it gave them, which was they fought for years and had not been able to get, was what we called a two-tier labor system. The arrangement was that the federal government would bail out Chrysler and General Motors if the union agreed to the following: that existing workers would continue to be paid at the old rate, roughly $29 U.S. per hour. But that all new hiring from the time of the bailout, roughly 2009 and 10, all new hires would be paid at roughly half, $15, $16 an hour. And what that meant was, as older workers retire, leave town, die, and are replaced by younger workers, and if the automobile companies would have some growth and hire new people, the impact of that hiring would not be what it would have been before, because you're paying people half. And if you work out what $15 an hour means for a 40-hour week, it plants the person precisely in the poverty category maintained by the U.S. Census. So what you did is you helped the car companies, but in such a way that you couldn't help Detroit, because even if the car companies survive and even if they grow, the wage they will be paying to a growing percentage of their employees is not enough to reverse the decline of Detroit, which has continued from the bailout in 2009 to the present, getting worse and worse and forcing the bankruptcy.
You know, it's interesting because the terms of the bailout suggest that it was the high wages that were the problem, that are the problem with the auto industry collapsing and thus Detroit collapsing. But you say, no, it's not the high wages that were the problem.
No, because the relative high wages enjoyed by auto workers has been true in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s. They had higher wages than their counterparts in auto companies elsewhere in the world. They had, in fact, much higher at that time. They had higher wages than other workers in the United States. However, the technology and the allure of the American automobile was such that they were able to be hired and indeed became the model for a well-paid American worker. So the fact that they get paid more was no detriment to the success years of the American auto industry. And to explain, therefore, why the situation changed, it's really not about the wages. It's about the catastrophic strategic errors made by the major shareholders and by the board of directors. I mean, the simplest example is you should have, in hindsight, and they failed, but you should have been able to see that when the Volkswagen company brings a little Beetle to the United States and teaches people the joys of using much less gas and having a simpler automobile, that the American companies would have understood that. They would have understood it from Toyota and Honda later, et cetera, et cetera. But they didn't. They tried to maintain what they had been producing all along. They focused on big automobiles, big SUVs, big pickup trucks, and they were outmaneuvered competitively by others. It's only very convenient to then suggest, so that they don't get blamed for what they're actually responsible for, that it has something to do with the medical insurance provided to workers or with their wages. Those were arrangements, those wage payments and those medical insurances that were negotiated in contract after contract that was not just signed by the union, but signed by the company, which believed, wrongly we now know, that it could make the right decisions to sustain after the 1970s the production structure, the profits, and the high wages that they had sustained before. But they made the wrong decisions, which is why now the big companies in the automobile business around the world have many names other than America.
Let's look at Detroit now in 2013. What's happening there right now?
Well, right now there's a lot of legal skirmishing. The person sent in by the governor, and it's important to remember that the governor is a Republican conservative and the city of Detroit is a bastion of Democratic liberal political organization and support. But having said that, the governor sent in a city manager when the finances became extreme a year or two ago, and that fellow has finally concluded that he can't do anything with the extensive powers that he actually had, given by the governor. And so he's taken this extreme step of basically throwing the question of Detroit's financial viability into the court system by declaring bankruptcy. What a bankruptcy court does in such circumstances is, first of all, evaluate what are the city's legal obligations financially, what are its revenues, and if, as is the case, the revenues fall far short of its legal obligations, then what a bankruptcy court does is sort out and determine which of the claimants on the city's money are going to get paid and how much are they going to get paid. And the three biggest ones are current employees in Detroit. That means the firefighters, the police persons, the school teachers, the clerks, all of that. That's one big claimant. The second one is bondholders. That's basically big banks and wealthy people and corporations who have lent money to the city of Detroit, as they lend money to all cities across the United States, and they hold the debts or the bonds of the city of Detroit, and they want to get paid back the interest and principal due them. And thirdly, there are the retired public employees, people who've given a lifetime of work as a school teacher or a firefighter or a police person, and who are entitled legally to have their medical payments covered to whatever the degree was of their policies, and to get their due pensions that were negotiated in good faith and signed by the city and the unions. So these are the three claimants. It gets complicated in Michigan because years ago a law was passed in the state legislature that specifically says that with or without a bankruptcy, a city must give priority to paying the pensions that it has contractually engaged with retired public employees. So there's now a question of whether this bankruptcy filing takes precedence over the law that was passed in Michigan or vice versa. Obviously, the pensioners are pushing for the law in Michigan to take precedence, and the bondholders, led by the biggest banks in the world, are pushing the other way because they want to get their money out of Detroit. And how that gets worked out will take years of legal wrangling.
What could the possible outcome be throughout the rest of the U.S.?
Well, it's terrifying, to be honest, and it would be already known to anyone listening to this program if it weren't that the very scariness about it leads an awful lot of editors to not deny the news, but to kind of downplay it. Here's the problem. Detroit is an extreme example of something that afflicts many American cities. For example, Cleveland, Ohio, Camden, New Jersey, Bridgeport, Connecticut. I mean, I could go on and on. There are literally hundreds of cities that are facing terrible budget problems. And the reason for that is everywhere obvious, although it's being muddied by conservatives who want to turn this situation to their advantage. The basic problem is the crisis since 2007. We have still unemployment in the United States, for example, of roughly 7.5%, which means we're not even halfway back from the 10% we had in 2010 to the 4.8% we had before this crisis hit in 2007. So we have millions, let me underscore that, millions of Americans unemployed. And not only that, those who still have their jobs are uniformly facing, with very few exceptions, less job security, fewer benefits that go with the jobs, medical coverage, pensions, and so on. Everywhere those are being reduced. The result is that Americans are not spending the kind of money they once did, which means they cannot maintain their properties, their homes and lands, which means that the property tax revenue of cities and towns is diminishing relentlessly year after year. We are now in the sixth year of this crisis with no end in sight. Bottom line, cities and towns like Detroit, like Camden, like Cleveland, are suffering a long-term decline in their economic resources, in their revenues. I'm not even speaking about the corporations that keep leaving the United States to take advantage of cheaper labor, particularly in Asia and Latin America, but in other places as well. That further erodes what we call the tax base of a city's finances. And the result is cities are everywhere in extreme difficulty. We've had more than 500,000 public school teachers laid off by American school systems across the United States over the last 4 years. I don't have the numbers for police and fire, but it's comparable in its impact. So it is a very, very serious long-term decline, which is visible across the country. But it's a little terrifying because you don't really know until it gets very extreme how bad it is. And the reason for that is that the accounting rules governing American cities, and I don't know enough to know what the situation is by comparison in Canada, but here in the United States, the rules are very confused, very murky, often vary from one jurisdiction to another. And so when I, as a professional economist, try to sit down and say, what is the condition of any particular city, it turns out to be an immensely complicated job for which I need accountants and mathematicians, and even then you get wildly different estimates of what the actual financial conditions are. I think the way to see it is this. Until the 1970s in general, and then until 2007 more particular, the American, the U.S. economy was strong enough, rich enough, and growing at a reasonable enough rate that all of these kinds of problems could be kind of swept under the rug, assumed that they wouldn't explode, and that we could somehow muddle through. But once the broad contours of the American economy changed after the 1970s, and now that we've had this serious breakdown since 2007, all of the hidden, repressed, obscure problems of the American economy, and they are many and they run deep, are now bubbling to the surface, and they are depressing and overwhelming the population.
Well, it's been really interesting talking to you this morning, Richard, and I'm going to refer people to your website so that they can follow up more. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Anytime.
I've been speaking with Richard Wolff. He's Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He's also host of the syndicated radio show Economic Update. If you would like to find out more information, you can visit his website, which is RD Wolff, and Wolff is spelt with two Fs, rdwolff.com.